This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
It's finally happened. 7:03, welcome to it. This is your Wednesday edition of Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. It's finally happened. Malusi Gigaba stepping down as a cabinet member and Minister of Home Affairs. Tasha, our bet is completely off, clearly.
Yeah, so I don't know whether we switch things and say whoever had the furthest and latest date is the one who wins because they were far closer to it.
So whoever had last week Friday, is that what we're saying? Because everyone assumed that it would be out by last week.
Yeah, so I don't know. I think just scrap it.
Yeah,
I think
complete conversation clearly happening there between Malusi Gigaba, the president, and the National Working and Executive Committee of the ANC indeed. And Malusi Gigaba bowing to pressure and finally saying indeed that it is time for him to fall on his sword. The second minister to do so. There are questions as to who is next. And of course, a lot of people questioning whether Bathabile Dlamini may indeed still remain in office after, you know, the end of this year. But with elections coming up, that's going to be something else to look at. But Dash, we do have a jam-packed show as well today.
Yes, so irrespective of the fact that there is some stock market volatility and a troubled economy and various other things, it seems as though local investors have committed a healthy 54 billion rand net inflows to the local collective investment schemes industry in the third quarter of this year. So we'll speak to Sunette Mulder, who is a senior policy advisor at ASISA, about that.
We'll unpack Malusi Gigaba's resignation and, of course, the court's decision then to grant the application to liquidate VBS Mutual Bank, the South African Reserve Bank, applying for that in court yesterday and were essentially successful. But now it may speed up court proceedings and criminal proceedings in that. We'll unpack that in just a moment.
And staying with that theme, there's been a recent trend, as Arabile has alluded to, where either companies opt for business rescue or sometimes even liquidation. We'll speak to Faith Ngwenya, who's a technical executive at SIPA, about which one to choose for which situation.
He may have gotten rid of Gigaba, but he also fired Tom Moyane. Why is the removal of the former SARS commissioner very key to President Cyril Ramaphosa's success? Dirk Kotze from the University of South Africa will unpack that for us and give us a little hint as to why this matters so much.
And we've often heard this on numerous platforms where people will say something along the lines of Africa doesn't need charity, it needs good leadership. We'll speak to Dr. Martin Davies, who's the Managing Director of Emerging Markets in Africa, Deloitte Africa. But how exactly do we even get to that point? And how are we doing so far?
And of course, the big story, municipal debt at Eskom amounting to around, to Eskom rather, amounting to 17 billion rand. Are we at risk of falling off now and getting more when it comes to blackouts as well for the country? How is this going to be affected? And we'll chat to Kulupasiwa from Eskom about that. All that and a whole lot more coming up between now and 8 o'clock. Let's get into your Wednesday edition of Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
This is Classic Business Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
Well, the dollar was on a speedy rally, but that seemed to have paused yesterday. Although that didn't necessarily help South Africa's stock exchange, with miners under pressure and continuing to fall by, with the likes of Naspers also offsetting gains by local banks. The all-share down nearly a third of a percent yesterday to 52,109 points, with the top 40 also going down. The banking sector was up 1.78%, with the food and drug retailers also gaining 0.71%. Global markets generally higher, and that's despite a sharp sell-off in tech stocks on Monday. So the tech stock tumble continues in earnest on that front. Of course, questions around the Brexit negotiations and possible conflict within the Eurozone over the Italian budget deficit seem to have taken the spotlight as well. So banks and retailers were given some support by a continued fall in the oil price as well, this time after U.S. President Donald Trump once again took to Twitter saying he thought oil prices should indeed be lower, especially given current output. 14.44 for a U.S. dollar, 16.30 for a euro, 18 rand and 74 cents for a single British pound. Taking a look at how things are looking out in Asia, it's all red right now across that board. 21,801 points for the Nikkei. It's down 0.05%. The Shanghai Composite, a tenth of a percent lower, 2,652 odd. While the Hang Seng in Hong Kong is down 0.5%, 25,664. It's $1,202 a fine ounce for gold. Platinum will set you back $836.55 an ounce. Brent crude, having fallen, is now at $65.44 a barrel.
This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
It's just gone 8 minutes after seven, and to talk more in-depthly on the markets, we're joined in studio by Michael Traherns, a portfolio manager at Vestec Asset Management. Michael, thank you so much for your time. It's Wednesday, so how do you, I mean, what do you make of the way the market started from the beginning of this week? I mean, I was reading the newsletter that you guys write, and you, there's this very interesting line where you say, there's an old saying about the nail that sticks out gets hit. And in this case, as Arabile said in his intro, it's the tech store.
Yeah, so it's been an interesting week. I mean, even if you look at our market yesterday, we started off in the green, then we were in the red, and then we were in the green, and then we just slowly drifted down to red. The market seems to be lacking direction. I mean, I was having a look at the NASDAQ last night. It closed up 0.0000088. So it was less than a point. That's after being about 0.5% in the green earlier in the day. So it just shows you that there's a lot of uncertainty out there. When I was talking about the nail getting hit, tech stocks over the last 2-3 years have been the major performers for US markets. They've done really well. I mean, the likes of Amazon, it's almost more than tripled in value over that time. They're the stocks that everyone talks about. They're the stocks that everyone focuses on. So when you got a sell-off like this, these are the ones that guys sell first, and you get that term taking profit. Guys take profit on the ones that they've made the most money on, you know, lock it away for psychological security.
Right. And when it comes to either corporate or just global news events that caught your attention yesterday, which one of those?
Yeah, so, excuse me. Brait's one of our old investments, but it's a company that we've been following, and it's just interesting to see it's because it's linked to the Christa Visa stable, and that's, it's not quite yesterday's news, but it came out on Monday afternoon, which meant I was reading it on Tuesday morning. And they was just breaking down how well they've done over like a 7 or 8 year period. But with their New Look asset, which is equivalent to Mr. Price in the UK, it's destroyed billions of dollars worth of shareholder wealth. And it's interesting to see, even though you've got all these amazing investments, it only takes one investment to bring down the house. So it's a sad story to see.
What is a sad story to see? So I was reading about Rebosis, and I had a look at the results. But the one thing that caught my attention is that, you know, it brought up the topic of a lot of these companies that went to the UK and bought some assets there. And because of situations probably out of their control and what's happening with regards to Brexit, things didn't work out as well. Brait probably is one of them. I think that the theme is there as well. Perhaps even famous brands. But because there is news, or there was news yesterday, that Theresa May, they may have some kind of ideas to how this divorce is going to work, or at least present the legal opinion as to what's going to happen with Brexit. Does that, you know, give you some kind of, I don't know, glimmer of hope that Theresa may find her way through this long, long dark tunnel that they're navigating through?
Yeah, it's very difficult. When you remember that Theresa May is pro-staying. She's not pro-Brexit, but because of her job, she has to be pro-Brexit. So it's very difficult. And then she's fighting her own cabinet. And then once she's fought them, then she's got to fight the opposition. And once she's got through the opposition in the House of Commons, then she has to get whatever deal through the House of Lords. It's a continual uphill battle. And they're running too close to their deadline at the moment. So it's tough. All the markets want is some level of certainty. And that's what's been lacking. Is a lot of international companies are saying, should we invest in the UK? And the answer is, well, we have to wait and see what the Brexit outcome is. And it's a similar, I think, story to where South Africa is at the moment, where investors say, should we invest in South Africa? And it's, well, let's wait and see what happens with the land issue. Let's wait and see what happens with the elections next year. And it's almost like the economy's on pause. And we need certainty for the floodgates to open because there's money around. And there's enough reports showing the balance sheets of big multinationals, and particularly South Africa-based multinationals, that have a lot of cash on their balance sheet. And asset prices in South Africa at the moment look very cheap. I mean, if you have a look, about once or twice a week, there's news of a small cap getting bought out.
Yeah.
And that just shows you that small caps representing asset classes as a whole are just too cheap, and guys are saying, look, we can buy out these small caps and make money from it. And I think we need certainty is the main thing.
Speaking of small caps, I mean, locally, there's been quite a lot of news about companies that are either delisting or planning to delist at some point. Is it a case where perhaps maybe private investors are seeing something on the JSE in terms of value that we may not have been seeing? I mean, there was, I think it was Clover, which came out on October 19th saying that there is a third party that may be interested in buying them and taking them private.
Yeah, so I think Clover's one, Tor's another one, I think it came out yesterday, the day before, Interwaste 2 weeks ago. These are all smaller companies, and there's just the big companies that are saying these assets are too cheap, we can buy them at a reasonable multiple, in most cases lower than 10, which is below the average of the market, and then you take these things private. In other cases, there's a lot of small cap companies that shouldn't have been listed in the first place. There's the lure of come to the market, the glitz and glamour, and then they realize all the regulatory burdens and the cost of being listed. It's very expensive. So it's a case of you got to choose what market you want to be in. And I think if you're seeing all these small caps, you're probably going to see a small cap boom in the next couple of years as our economy surges from our election. So I'm saying that we're going to surge from our election. And if I keep saying it, hopefully it'll build confidence.
All right. It's 7:15. We still have Michael Trehearne in studio.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
Well, it's finally at a stage now where the vendor banking society's mutual bank has now been called for to be put into liquidation by the courts. And at the same time, Malusi Gigaba resigned. It's obviously not two of the exact same issues here, but certainly two factors that we will be discussing over the next few minutes or so with Lumkile Mondi, senior economist and a lecturer at Wits University. Mr. Mondi, thank you so much for your time. The Prudential Authority head CEO, Kuben Naidu, saying, of course, that the court order gives them more power now to recover money from those that stole it or owe the bank. A good move, you reckon, for South Africa?
No, this is fantastic. This is, in fact, what the Prudential Authority should be doing in terms of ensuring that all the time depositors are taken care of. And you mustn't forget that this is also a very, very sad chapter in the history of the Republic, where then the vendor government, together with entrepreneurs, set out to ensure that the financial inclusion and access to financial architecture through VBS. So really, this liquidation of VBS is a sad chapter, and I think for the ANC, they should really be very embarrassed that in the 25 years, we're seeing what they are incapable of. And what they're capable of. What they're capable of is the destruction of institutions. I think the VBS is the first one, and I think there's more that's going to be coming going forward, including the SAA and many others.
Yeah, so you believe, do you think this sets, you know, banking sort of backwards, particularly for mutual banking?
It sets it backward, but also in Schumpeterian sense, institutions, Mr. Kumete, they come up. And if they don't innovate, they get destroyed. So in this case, it's a huge opportunity for entrepreneurs to really, with this window that's been opened, to seize the opportunity and bring in the offering, which will be more faster, more innovative, and much better than VBS.
Yeah.
So it's an opportunity.
Well, former finance minister and also now former home affairs minister Malusi Gigaba also resigning yesterday. I'm sure it really doesn't matter at whose request it really was, but the fact that he is gone sort of does tell you that the cleanup continues in government.
Well, in fact, I don't think it's a cleanup. I mean, I remember that, the priority of President Ramaphosa is the unity of the ANC.
Mm.
I think in this case, because he lied under oath, as the Constitutional Court has showed, but secondly, the ongoing saga with firstly the public protector, but generally, he can't be trusted. You know, I think he had gone too far in terms of him being given opportunity. The cleanup is never going to happen. Remember that the main constraint in South Africa is the priority for unity of the ANC, not the development of the country, not ensuring that there's inclusiveness in terms of access to communal opportunities, but the priority that the ANC and President Ramaphosa have set themselves is to unify themselves. So there's no discussion about poverty, about unemployment. The ANC comes first. The unity of the ANC comes first.
Yeah. From here on, what do you think happens to the likes of, the likes of Bathabile Dlamini, who are also estranged when it comes to ANC leadership, and perhaps other leaders who perhaps are a little bit, here and there?
Well, the only way to do anything really will be if they are exposed to legal processes. Anything else coming from the ANC or anyone else is going to be very, very difficult. I think we now know what ANC is about. So if South Africans don't know, perhaps they should think twice. We know what they're about. They're about themselves. They're about the self-interest of those that have been elected by them. And they've got no interest in the country. Arabile, in a country with 7.5% unemployment, with poverty level so high and growth so low, and yet there is no economic strategy. It is really very disappointing. That should be the priority, not the priority of individuals who, in fact, are implicated in malfeasance. So, really, this is what we have. And I think up until an election in 2019, if South Africans choose them again, they'll know what they're getting into. They're getting into the same old record that's been playing in the past 5 years.
Lumkile Mondi, appreciate your time. Senior economist and lecturer at Wits University, appreciated there. Two sagas that indeed will continue to reverberate throughout South Africa's government and certainly throughout South Africa's banking industry. It's 7:20, your traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
23 minutes after 7, well, seemingly undeterred by stock market volatility or troubled economy, local investors have committed a healthy 54 billion rand in net inflows into the local collective investment schemes industry in the third quarter of this year. And to talk to us about it is Sunet Mulder, who's a senior policy advisor at ASISA. Sunet, thank you so much for your time this morning. Before we get into the findings of what ASISA has put together, perhaps let's define what we mean when we say collective investment schemes industry.
Good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to speak to the listeners. The collective investment schemes industry is colloquially known as the unit trust industry. That is where investors pool their funds into portfolios that then gets invested into the stock market, into the bond market, into international markets. So you have the ability to gain exposure to the market, sometimes by quite a lot smaller amounts than you would if you had to invest directly into, for example, the stock exchange.
All right. Now, based on this, what's driving, this healthy appetite that investors seem to have?
We were quite surprised to see, with everything going on, that investors were still positive. But we did see quite an improvement in the flows of the last few quarters. We went from quite a low quarter in March to one of the highest quarters in the past year, with 54 billion committed. And I think people understand that they need to save for retirement, they need to save for certain things that they need to pay for, like their child's education, or possibly to do repairs to a house, etc. So people understand that they need to save. Obviously, we would like them to even save more to make sure they can cover all these things. But I think there is a building of an understanding the importance of saving for your future.
All right. So now when you look at your stats and your research, where did the money go?
The money, interestingly enough, went to mostly into interest-bearing short-term and variable-term portfolios. So these are mostly portfolios that would invest in, for example, your bond market. And then on the other side, there were also strong inflows into equity, which came as a bit of a surprise because over the past few years, the trend has been going into multi-asset portfolios. And if I say multi-asset, these are portfolios that have some bond exposure, some equity exposure, and possibly some international exposure. So that trend has seemed to turn a little bit. And now it seems the investors and the advisors are starting to actually invest directly into these sectors rather than making use of the multi-asset portfolios. That being said, the multi-asset portfolios still had a strong quarter, but relatively spoken, it's come down in for the quarter.
When you look at some of the stats, I remember reading where you mentioned that it's impossible to draw any meaningful conclusions when it comes to investor sentiment from the current flow patterns because it's very divergent. I mean, is that concerning that these patterns are a little divergent, or is that normal?
I think it might just be a sign of the times. Everything seems to move in cycles. So it seems like we've gone through the cycle of leaving the asset allocation decision to the portfolio managers, and that was the big move into asset allocation portfolios, whereas now it seems to have gone to the other way, where investors and their advisors have decided to take the asset allocation decision upon themselves by making their own between interest-bearing and equity.
When it comes to offshore focus, do you give stats on that, and what does it look like?
So the offshore focus, we provide information on collective investment schemes that's approved by the FSCA to be sold in South Africa. We call it the foreign collective investment schemes. So these are offshore managers that sell their funds into the South African market. And the assets under management as at the end of the quarter of September was sitting at 514 billion rand.
Sinet, thank you so much for your time. That's Sinet Mulder, who's a senior policy advisor at ASISA. Michael, I'm going to bring you into this conversation. So I read an article that's saying that the Bank of America Merrill Lynch, the latest investor survey, showed that the US is still the most favored equity region for global fund managers. You guys like it quite a bit, right?
Yeah, so we've got two businesses, one in South Africa and one where we invest in the US. And our U.S. business has gone from strength to strength, and our local business is busy fumbling along. And that's because U.S. equities are growing. Yeah. Local stuff's not. And as humans, we have this innate desire to invest where things are growing. So we've seen a lot of our clients say, we don't want to have our money anymore in South Africa. We want to take it to the U.S., partly because of political concerns, but a bigger part of it is your money would have been better under a mattress than in the South African equity market for the last 4 years. Yeah. And those sort of results have an impact, and people have moved a lot of money offshore. And that's where our biggest growth market is at the moment, is guys saying we want to have the money offshore. And then the other advantage to offshore is there's 4,000 companies there. In JSE, there's only about 300 companies and only about 50 that are even half worth looking at.
Speaking of results, you're waiting for a company that's publishing their numbers at midday today.
Yes, Tencent. So Tencent's down 47% from its high earlier this year, which means Naspers has been caned. So expect big moves from Naspers at about 12:30 when those Tencent numbers come out. How have Chinese regulations on games impacted them?
All right. Key things that you're going to be looking out for, at least one thing before we go into news headlines.
There's EU GDP numbers today, I think. But by far, the Tencent numbers, that's going to take all my focus for the rest of the day. And then the Discovery Bank. Don't forget Discovery Bank.
Yep, that launches today at around 1 o'clock as well. Adrian Gore will be having a press conference regarding that. But let's get into your news headlines.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
He's been able to remove quite a few people from office, and some voluntarily. The likes of Supra Mahamapelo. Of course, President Jacob Zuma was the initial start. We saw Malusi Gigaba yesterday. Nhlanhla Nene stepping down, of course, not so long ago. But Professor Dirk Kotza believes that the removal of former SARS Commissioner Tom Moyane is certainly one of the key elements to President Cyril Ramaphosa's success. We chat to Professor Dirk Kotza from the University of South Africa now. Professor, thank you so much for your time this morning. Let's perhaps detail why you believe this was essentially the most important firing, shall we say, of President Cyril Ramaphosa's tenure thus far.
Well, I think first of all, one has to look at what is the position and the significance of SARS in the different capacities that it serves in society. Because the fact that Tom Moyane was in charge of this SARS meant that to a large extent it could use the SARS as an institution, as a state institution in its different capacities. First of all is the fact that SARS is absolutely essentially important for the implementation of the fiscal policy of the government, because that it generates the revenue for government. Without that, it is impossible for government actually to govern, because they won't have money in order to implement anything, whether it's their policies or their programs or their service delivery, anything of that. So if there's a person in that position which is undermining the capacity or taking steps which in the end undermines the ability of SARS in order to gather that revenue, and then it has dire implications on government. Secondly, we've seen over time how SARS has become absolutely a key institution in the state capture idea, because they were in a sense linking the private sector and many of the private sector networks with that of government. It also inevitably links some of the organized crime in the syndicates with some aspects of that. The fact that Tom Moyane removed most of the investigative capacity of SARS meant that the effectiveness of SARS in respect of that was also undermined. And then thirdly is the effect that Tom Moyane had ultimately on the internal politics of the ANC, because SARS became a very divisive element within government as well as in the ANC. One can think, for example, about the position of Pravin Gordhan, how he became a bone of contention between the different factions within the ANC. We see that he is accused now of also trying to protect the so-called white monopoly capital, that he is an opponent of radical economic transformation, which all sort of can be converted or traced back to the campaign last year within the ANC about the elections that took place at their national conference. So in that sense, if he's not there anymore, it opened up some new space for President Ramaphosa that he didn't have in the past.
Yeah. One of the things as well is that, being part of Revenue Service means that you get personal information on individuals, and that could be very manipulative, and it has the manipulative potential to politicians and to everyone else, and clearly Tom Moyane could have played in that space as well then.
For sure. It very much links up with the intelligence capacity of government in terms of its three arms of intelligence, the military and the police and national intelligence. At the same time, just think about, for example, the position or the relationship of Julius Malema with SARS. You know, how that can manipulate depending on what is his current or his previous tax record. And that can be used either to intimidate him or in order to, in a sense, bring him closer to them, almost to co-opt him. So there's huge potential for abuse of that information. We also saw it in the way in which they accused the so-called rogue unit of gathering that type of information.
Yeah.
So it played into that idea of SARS is much more than simply collecting taxes. It has a huge database with very sensitive information there that is potentially can be politically explosive.
Yeah, so I mean, it was aimed at some point really combating crime when it came to things like illegal cigarettes, contraband as well, coming in and out of the country, seizing those type of things. But now it became the criminal hub itself. So one begs the question, though, was it absolutely clear from the onset that he was there to promote and protect President Jacob Zuma's interests? Or was he, do you think, just a very willing agent, you know, that happened to agree with the mandate that was clearly the status quo at the time, which was state capture?
Well, I think we are going to see, receive an answer for that over time. It is not at this stage absolutely clear of what exactly was the role that he played. I think he played a combination of the two, that he was certainly very close to President Zuma, and if we think, look at his political background, he actually met President Zuma in Mozambique during his time of exile. Mm. And we've seen over time how the acquaintances of President Zuma that he gathered around him during his time in Maputo as a deputy representative of the ANC and very much involved in internal intelligence, how that subsequently that those people became very close to President Zuma in government. And Tom Moyane is one of them. So in that sense, I think it did serve the purpose of President Zuma, but at the same time, with what we've now talked about, the way in which he closed down the investigative capacity of SARS and how it undermined their ability to deal with organized crime, that by implication it served their purposes also. So we will have to see how it plays out over time. The Nugent Commission can give us some indication. I think the longer commission will also be able to give us more of an indication.
Sure.
If one reads, for example, the books by Johan van Lochenberg, who was sort of implicated in the so-called drug, he's very explicit about those. So there is already some information, but I think we will have to see over time how it plays out.
Professor, it's just as important then for the whoever takes over. I know Moyane hasn't necessarily completely disappeared because he has challenged the decision and is going to court, but it's now going to be just as important as to who replaces him.
Yes, that is indeed so. And I think what we need now is someone who's with no overt political linkages, with no political alliances, in order to create credibility and independence for SARS. That it must become again credible that anyone, any person of South Africans as well as businesses in South Africa must understand that it's not a means towards an end, the role that SARS is playing.
Yeah, it's a very, very important one. Professor Dirk Kotz, I appreciate your time there for the professor in political science at the University of South Africa. 7:40, your traffic.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
At 7:42, yesterday VBS Mutual Bank came out with a statement saying that they'll be liquidated after an application by the South African Reserve Bank's Prudential Authority was unopposed at the High Court in Pretoria. We do know that the bank was placed under curatorship in March after looting by executives led to a liquidity crisis. But today we're going to be talking about business rescue or liquidation. Which path do you choose? And to talk to us about it, we're joined on the line by Faith Ngwenya, who's a technical executive at SIPA. Faith, thank you so much for your time this morning. So, okay, let's define business rescue and liquidation. Let's start off with business rescue. What are the circumstances that would generally be occurring for a company to go down that route?
Morning, Nastasia. Business rescue, it is a process where a company finds itself in financial distress. And at that time, the entity must not be insolvent. Then the company, which will be the creditors or the shareholders, apply for business rescue through the courts, which will obviously see the entity being turned around. A plan has to be put together, which will propose how the entity will be turned around. And obviously, if successful, then the business will continue to exist as is. On the other hand, if an entity is unable to pay its creditors, and in most cases, it has liabilities exceeding its assets, it then obviously there is no prospects for that entity being resuscitated back to life, then it can itself voluntarily apply for liquidation, or the creditors or other stakeholders can apply for the liquidation of that entity. If the court grants the liquidation order, then the liquidation ceases to exist immediately upon the order being passed, and it will go through the liquidation process.
You mentioned in your statement that a recent trend has emerged in South African businesses where shutting their businesses is to opt for the path of business rescue as opposed to liquidation. Do they go for that path because they assume that it will stall the liquidation point of view, even though their financial statements are at a point of no return?
Not necessarily. In most cases, you will see when your current liabilities, because when we're talking solvency, it's when your total liabilities. But an entity that sees that it's struggling to pay its creditors, but it's still in a solvent state. So its total assets are still more than its liabilities. That is where business rescue becomes a rescue plan. Also, it obviously then gives it time. Because what you do when you have applied for business rescue, the business rescue practitioner will negotiate with your creditors that they kind of stall calling for their payments whilst they are putting the plan into process. The debts are not being written off, but you obviously are not going to get the creditors breathing down your neck wanting payment because you are in business rescue. And once the process has gone through and the entity is back on a stable foot again, then they will be able to pay the debts that they had put at bay. So that obviously is the option that Chapter 6 of the Companies Act brought in, because previously, without business rescue, you obviously depleted the assets and you got into a state where you don't have any assets, there isn't a prospect of anything, and then the entity had to be closed down. So the advantage with business rescue, if successful, is that the entity does not stop operating. Jobs are not lost.
Yeah.
Creditors will still get their payment after the business has been successfully rescued. So that is where we obviously see the advantages in business rescue.
Faith, thank you so much for your time this morning. That's Faith Ngwenya, a technical executive at SIPA, laying out the options between business rescue or liquidation.
Every morning, Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Arensa on Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb.
In May, it stood at 14.3 billion rand, and by the end of September, it had risen to 17 billion rand. Cooperative Governance and Traditional Affairs Minister Zweli Mkhize saying that municipal debt owed to Eskom rising by a similar amount as well to municipalities that owe the same amount or thereabouts to water boards. So clearly, a big issue there going on when you take a look at how Eskom is collecting its debt, a big problem, and certainly the amount of money it really needs to keep afloat. Khulupasiwe, spokesperson for Eskom, joins us on the line now as we perhaps unpack this a little bit more and see how exactly this is hurting the state electricity maker. Khulu, thank you so much for your time this morning. How difficult is it that you have to keep lights on in some of these municipalities despite this debt burden?
It's a big problem, Ravile. We have a situation where some of these municipalities are not even trying. Let's take Malutiapofung, for example, in the Eastern Free State. They owe Eskom about 3 billion rand, and their matter has been taken, or previous cases until last week, have been taken to court. And once the matter is at the court, clearly you have to wait until the court has made a ruling. And generally what we have seen as a trend within all of these municipalities is that when the matter is at the court, they go on some kind of a payment holiday. And unfortunately, that's why you now have a situation where ultimately all of these municipalities put together are owing us 17 billion rand and counting.
Have they explained exactly why, though? I mean, if you look, as you said, at Malutiapofung in the Free State, that 3 billion being taken to court, that is an absolutely huge amount. And you say they're not even trying. What can you do other than taking them to court that perhaps will be of some slight benefit to yourselves, because this is certainly hurting the business and the nation as a whole?
Well, maybe just to clarify around the court case, usually it's the businesses in those areas that take those municipalities to court. The businesses are saying, we would like to get a court a permission, which will give us permission to pay Eskom directly. And that's how the matters get to court. From our side, the only recourse that we have is to withdraw our product, meaning we cut them off, and that's what we have been doing in other areas. But generally, we get stopped in our tracks in many cases when businesses go to court, because obviously when we cut off the municipality, they too, those companies and everyone else within those localities, they are customers of that municipality. So when we cut our customer, which is the municipality, everyone gets affected. So businesses usually take us to court, and that's how you get involved in this. From our end, we would disconnect, and we also advise them to also be on prepaid, which is also one of the suggestions that came in Parliament yesterday, where Minister Zweli Mkhize was saying municipalities might have to go the prepaid route. I think ultimately that will be the solution to all of these problems.
I can certainly see how that would be one solution as well. Kulu, how much of how at risk is Eskom right now then of rolling blackouts because of this? And does this actually put that much pressure on how Eskom can service the rest of the country?
Well, our finances are generally under pressure. Our bottom line is in financial dire straits, quite frankly. We need to do something in terms of improving our operations as a company at power station level to generate more electricity and sell electricity to those who are able to buy it. And those who are unable or unwilling to pay them, clearly we should stop supplying to them, including these municipalities. Eskom needs to make sure that we get this money. I heard in Parliament that one of the issues that they were mentioning is that there's a consideration that maybe some of this debt should be written off. Quite frankly, where we are at this stage as a company, we are not there yet. But because obviously we are being led by the Interministerial Committee, which is looking into various options, hopefully at some point there will be clarity. And yesterday, the minister did indicate that by the end of this month, there will be some report coming from the Interministerial Committee, which is led by COPTA. So we'll take a cue from them as to what's going to happen. But from our end, Arabile, we have said in many forums before that we can only write off debt if we know for sure that we're not going to have a repeat of this problem that we currently are sitting with. In 2002, Eskom had written off 1.4 billion rand of the Soweto debt. Right now, as I speak to you today, the Soweto debt is 12 billion rand. So clearly, writing off debt does not necessarily solve your problem. You need to make sure that you put measures in place, and those measures, among others, would include the fact that all of the customers in South Africa, including municipal customers, have to be on prepaid. That's the only way you can guarantee that you're going to get your revenue.
Kulupasio, appreciate your time. It is certainly a difficult one. And as you said, just writing off the debt does not necessarily put you at ease or change the way people do things when it comes to owing the money to Eskom. So hopefully that does get cleared up very soon. Kulupasio, the spokesperson of Eskom.
This is Classic Business. Breakfast with MoneyWeb. Arabile Gumede and Nastasia Aronsa on Classic 1027.
7:53, Africa's economic outlook is positive, and according to the IMF, almost half of the 40 fastest growing emerging and developing countries are on the continent. But given the risks linked to the over-reliance on resources, the focus on the continent has shifted towards creating ideas-driven economies. And to talk to us about why the continent doesn't need charity, it needs good leadership, is Dr. Martin Davies, who's the Managing Director of Emerging Markets and Africa at Deloitte Africa. Dr. Davies, thank you so much for your time this morning. Perhaps you can take us through some of the significant steps we've made on the continent, either on a political and on an economic side.
Surely. Hi, Anastasia. Well, this coming week we have a World Economic Forum education module for the young global leaders community from the West, and this is exactly the topic we're talking about, is how is Africa doing in terms of this thing called leadership and development and inclusive growth. Big phrases, but we don't see enough impact, I'm afraid, across the continent. And to put things in perspective, last week I was with the Minister of Finance of Nigeria. She's recently been appointed. And we had a conversation looking at the developmental changes in Nigeria. And did you know there are over 80 million people in Nigeria under the age of 14? And to begin to get your head around this and think, well, what are the what's the future of young people in Africa? Clearly, it can't once again be linked to very sort of fickle commodity cycles, which we remain in, I'm afraid. It can't be linked, well, we try to make a link towards manufacturing, but it's very difficult, particularly for vast majority of African states. Think hinterland, landlocked economies, very bad infrastructure, minimal connectivity. And, you know, we talk about how do we get innovation-driven economies, ideas-driven economies, entrepreneurial economies for younger people on the continent. There's no seemingly other option, and this is these are our issues we need to discuss, think about, more importantly, implement. The disconnect, however, is that it's very difficult to have young, entrepreneurial-driven societies when you have such old, stagnant leadership in many countries that we talk about, and that, I think, is a challenge.
Are we then, making new economic alliances with other countries as well, so that we can get to a point where there's a lot of interconnectivity between us, and we're also dealing with, creating jobs? I mean, 18 million jobs per year by perhaps even 2035. Are we getting somewhere?
Yeah, I'm going to set a job for you. You mentioned 18 million jobs across the continent required per year is probably, too conservative, too low an estimate. I think what we're seeing is we need to start to see, secondly, obvious, enhanced, and the AU is doing this, I think, to an extent, the EAC, maybe SADC less so. They're looking to connect Africans, greater connectivity across the continent. This is physical connections, this is flow of capital, of goods, almost like an EU perspective, a so-called four freedoms. Well, that's what we need in our continent, the flow of labor, i.e. people, the flow of capital, the flow of goods, and the flow of services. And that's done through sort of enhanced government into government-to-government collaboration, cooperation, and it's not just about Africans connecting, but us connecting to the world. I mean, look at Dubai. Dubai has, in 20 years, has come out of nowhere, has really built itself a role as being a hub for Africa, arguably, and the Middle East and South Asia. Why are not African cities, South Africa aside, Kenya, maybe Nairobi default in East Africa, Addis Ababa aspirational, but why are we not seeing more competition to create regional hubs, to manage these flows I talk about, capital, people, services, goods, etc., in our own region? The hubs are often sitting outside. But again, I think we need to, there's this often in our part of the world, I think particularly in Southern Africa, less so the rest of the continent, there's this almost suspicion of foreign capital, whether it's Chinese typically or others, that they're somehow exploiting the continent. That's ideological nonsense, and I think we need to really, more Africa requires more globalization, more flows, if you will, and to plug into the global economy.
Outside of Dubai, are there other countries on the continent that have surprised you in a good way, where you're actually giving them a second glance?
Undoubtedly, Natasha. I mean, you see, Rwanda always comes to mind, but Rwanda is a very small country. GDP is probably 16, 17 billion US dollars. We're roughly maybe 400 billion in South Africa. But it's incredibly efficient. It's just a few weeks ago, it was announced, and the only African country in the top 30 in the world, ranked by the World Bank, for ease of doing business. So Rwanda shooting the lights off, being a functional, highly practical, pragmatic state, minimal, zero corruption, and a place that enables capital and business. Ethiopia is another one. Ethiopia is a case in point. The country was at almost boiling point socially, politically, a number of months ago. New leader came in, new generation. He's in his early 40s. And it's incredible what a sort of a breath of fresh air of new, revitalized, younger leadership, dare I say, Obama style, has brought about in Ethiopia. And he's the new Prime Minister Abiy has been sort of spoken about and compared to sort of the Barack Obama of Ethiopia, and that's what's happening up there in that country. Morocco is another one. Morocco is a fantastic manufacturing platform. Morocco is becoming what Mexico is to North America in terms of manufacturing platform from the south. Morocco is to France and Southern Europe. So these are the countries, really. I think Ghana is coming right to an extent on the back of rising oil prices and getting its debt issues managed. Ivory Coast as well. I think, unfortunately, many countries in Southern Africa are lagging our own regional peers in terms of growth trajectory.
Dr. Davis, thank you so much for your time. This is Dr. Martin Davis, who is from Deloitte Africa.
Well, of course, that brings us to the end of the show. Quite a bit still happening across the board there. We did speak about that municipal debt. We're seeing as well that MTN is yet to hand over a contract to Vodacom that it had lost around 9 months ago. That's a 325 million rand contract. Whether that will continue to happen is something we'll unpack very close as well. So a whole lot still happening. And don't forget, Discovery launching that bank today. Tash, we'll get to chat to Adrian Gore, hopefully, tomorrow about that.
Goodbye.